It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Everyone, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. It's all about food. And we have a really great, great show with a great discussion topic today. And I want to remind you, you probably know this, but you can call in and make comments at 1-888-874-4888 or send an email during the show or any time during the week at info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. Love to hear from you. Love to hear your comments, happy, sad, inspiring, critical, whatever they may be. Let's keep the dialogue going. Okay, so today it's going to be I'm going to predict you're going to feel something during this hour. We have Mark Bekoff. Is it Bekoff or Bekoff, Mark?
Bekoff.
There you go. Okay, Mark Bekoff. He's Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and co-founder with Jane Goodall of, I can't even say this, Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Yep, you got it. Ethologists.
Very good. Ethology. I love the word. I'm going to use it. I've never used it before. But let me just give more of your bio here, and then we'll get started, because people need to know how wonderful and amazing you are. So Mark has won many awards for his scientific research, including the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. Mark has written more than 200 articles, numerous books, and has edited 3 encyclopedias. His books include the Encyclopedia of Animal Rights and Animal Welfare, the 10 Trusts with Jane Goodall, the Encyclopedia of Animal Behavior, the Encyclopedia of Human-Animal Relationships, Minding Animals, Animal Passions, and Beastly Virtues, Reflections on Redecorating Nature, The Emotional Lives of Animals, Animals Matter, Animals at Play, a children's book, Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals with Jessica Pierce, and The Animal Manifesto, 6 Reasons for Increasing Our Compassion Footprint. In 2005, Mark was presented with the Bank One Faculty Community Service Award for the work he has done with children, senior citizens, and prisoners. In 2009, he became a scholar in residence at the University of Denver's Institute for Human-Animal Connection and a faculty member of the Humane Society University. In 2009, he also was presented with the St. Francis of Assisi Award by the New Zealand SPCA. Mark, welcome to It's All About Food.
Wow, that was a mouthful.
It was a mouthful, but you did all of it. You are one amazing individual, and I'm sure somehow in the great consciousness of all living beings, everyone is thankful for you.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you, Karen.
Yeah. So, okay, I think people might get the gist of what we're going to be talking about based on some of the titles of your books.
Mm-hmm.
But you have this knowledge or some kind of connection with animals and their emotions and their feelings. What is it? Where does that come from?
Oh, well, you know, my parents told me that when I was a kid, I would always mind animals, which became the title for a book of mine. I was always asking them what animals are thinking, mm-hmm. what they know, and what they're feeling. And so I was always concerned about their well-being. So it started early, but I didn't grow up in a house with animals. My mom had been bitten by a dog and was actually afraid of an animal. She was afraid of animals but didn't, you know, disparage them. But there was a very warm peaceful, pacifist atmosphere in my house.
Mm.
I think just spilled over into a lot of avenues of my life. I consider myself really a lucky guy.
Now, let me ask you, do you live with non-human animals?
Well, I live in the mountains in Colorado, so I've got cougars, coyotes, black bears, and red foxes visiting my house with a pretty regularly. I have not had a companion dog. Oh, geez, almost 8.5, 9 years since my buddy Jethro died. But I do run a daycare dog care center, and my friends bring their dogs to my house so that they won't be alone when the humans are working for them, because, of course, you know, we all work for our animals.
Right.
And so any day I've got between maybe 2 and 5 animals around my house, dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm never without animals. Last night I was actually just watching a movie, and a mouse was running loops around my couch. So that's fine. You know,
that's fine.
He or she, or their his or her ancestors were here far long before I was. So that's okay.
Well, science has done great things for us, but it's also done some disservice over time, and some of the philosophers have really put out some very damaging information when it came to animals and their souls, their emotions, their intellectual capacity, and really set the ground for us believing that there's nothing inside of these living species. And it's taken quite some time to build up a case to show that they do. It's pretty obvious to me. I'm not really a person who hangs around with a lot of animals, but you know, just stroking a cat or hanging out with a dog, you know that they're not just moving around without anything going on in their head. You just look into their eyes and you see things, you see thoughts, you see emotions, you see feelings. And unfortunately, this belief that there's nothing within animals has allowed us to do things like vivisection, harm animals in so many ways, I want to think that we believed when we were doing these harmful, when we do these things, that animals aren't feeling anything, but there are probably some that would do it anyway, thinking that animals feel something.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm a scientist, and I really like science, so my views aren't anti-science, but science has come a long way, and it can afford to go a long way, but a lot of what we know about animal emotions, the moral lives of animals, say how intelligent they are, you know, science is finally catching up with what a lot of us know. So it's not to disparage science, but it is to say that in some ways science has halted the progress we could make if we listened more to good stories that people tell. I mean, stories alone aren't enough, but, you know, we have to open our heads and our hearts to what is going on around us. And as a scientist, I've always just been against dissection and vivisection. And sometimes it was rough going, but, you know, in the end, I think compassion and humaneness and empathy prevail.
Well, there's no question that as a society we have really distanced ourselves from nature in general, and that's not just relationships with other animal species, but our relationship with the earth, our relationship with our food and growing food, and our relationship with nurturing the environment. It's all been distanced, and as a result, we've done a lot of damage. We see it with the air pollution, the soil degradation, the water pollution. The list is endless. Mm-hmm. And children today, for example, most of them have no idea where their food comes from. It comes from the supermarket. You know, some of them at a young age don't even know apples come from trees. And we're so distant.
Or that a bacon lettuce and tomato sandwich is really a babe lettuce and tomato sandwich.
Yeah.
No, they don't. I think your point is really I do a lot of work with Jane Goodall, and as part of her Roots and Shoots programs for kids, I interact with a lot of kids, and they are simply astounded at a certain age when they learn that a cow or a hamburger was a cow.
Yeah.
They just don't know this, and I think we're obliged, not only to inform this, to inform them of this information, but also, like you said, the amazing environmental damage that factory farms and slaughterhouses do in, local and more global communities.
Well, not only have we distanced ourselves from all of this, and kids aren't aware of where things come from, in some ways we've created fantasy where things like McDonald's with the hamburger patch, where hamburgers come from a garden of hamburger patches, so you create you don't only not spread the truth, but you create lies.
Yes, and I'm so glad you raised that. I've had emails about that, and I just encourage people to, ask people to walk their talk. I mean, I personally would love the world to be vegan.
Me too.
A vegetarian, but I'm a realist, and
yeah.
I know it won't be. But in my latest book called The Animal Manifesto, I developed this idea called the compassion footprint. And when people go, it's so hard to be vegetarian or vegan, and I'm thinking, well, I travel 100+ thousand miles a year in all sorts of countries.
Mm-hmm.
Can always find salad and pasta and rice and beans,
mm-hmm.
Perfectly healthy food. But I am a realist, and I know people are not going to, say, sometimes give up their steak or their hamburger. So I think we just have to all walk the talk, own our decisions, and make the most humane decisions we can. And with respect to food, there's more pain and suffering and death on factory farms than in all other venues of animal use combined.
That's right.
I mean, it's not even, it's off scale. It's almost logarithmic compared
mm-hmm.
to all other use of animals combined. So I tell people that, look, if you want, sometimes people say, well, how can I make a difference? And I always tell them, like with respect to your radio show or if I'm giving a talk, I'll just say, well, you can make a difference when you leave this room. You can go to a restaurant, ask the source of the meat if you're going to have it, and if they don't know it or you can tell they're lying that they don't know, then choose a vegetarian alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So some people get upset with me because they feel that I'm not, walking a hard enough line. But I do walk a hard line, but I'm also a realist to know that nobody likes to be told what to do.
Right.
And the best way to lose somebody is to be prescriptive. So you don't tell them what to do. You show them what to do. The other thing that I always put forth is that, typically it's not what's for dinner, it's who's for dinner. That the vast, except, of course, putting invertebrates aside. I'm not putting them aside. I wouldn't eat them. But, of the vertebrates, they're all sentient beings. They all have deep feelings. They all have moral lives. They love their friends and their families. They feel pain and they suffer. They feel pain. They feel their own pain and their own suffering and that of other individuals around them. So I always say it's who's for dinner, not what's for dinner. And I've actually had people come up to me after talks and say they had never thought of that and they would never again eat an animal. Well, and I don't mean that in a bravado way.
Yes.
I just mean that
the veil is lifted
half the time. We kind of walk through life. We're all busy.
Yeah.
And we just don't realize how easy it would be to increase and expand our compassion footprint and make the world a better place.
Well, that's the thing. It really is easy. I've been doing it for decades, and I know how easy it is, but so many people feel that it is so challenging. And when it's getting easier over time because there are more convenient foods available that are vegetarian. But still, some people, when you mention you're vegan, they get this blank stare in their face, like, "What do you eat?" They cannot imagine eating anything that doesn't have meat, and yet so many things that most people eat don't have meat in them. there are plenty of standard dishes that don't have meat or don't have to have meat, don't have to have dairy. It's not that difficult, but it's just part of it is this mindfulness that you mentioned where we're walking through life somewhat like zombies in some way, just doing our routine and not really connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, people feel so powerless that they can't make a difference in the world. All these things are going wrong, and yet something so simple as saying, who's for dinner? It may not get to everyone, but it gets to some people. And then there are these little triggers. One, so it's great that we have different people spreading this message because everybody's got their own little nugget that works, and different people will respond to different things, and we need more of that out there so that we can trip that switch so that more people get it.
Yes, and I like that. You use the word little nugget. I sometimes use, you know, like a bumper sticker. You know, just like something that it can be bulleted. Think of that the individual into whom you're putting a fork was a sentient being. I wrote an essay recently called Dead Cow Walking in honor of, if you will, but also to get people not to celebrate National Hamburger Day.
I read it. It was an excellent article, and congratulations for having it printed in Psychology Today.
Well, thank you, because, you know, that's what it is. It's dead cow walking. It's dead pig walking. But I don't want to rely, you know, I don't want to depend on sort of the horror stories. I just think that you're so right, Karen. We all have our little nuggets. So when I say to friends that, you know, the chicken you're looking at, or the pig or the bacon, is on a platter of death, a platter of suffering. One of my friends, and I simply really can't ever expose his name, who works in the food industry, he loves his job, and I'm glad he's there. You know, I'm glad that good people are working in industries where animals are used, because they will bring around, you know, humane changes. He basically says that when you're eating an animal, or you're eating or consuming animal products, you're eating misery. You know, but once again, you know, in the real world, there are gradations. So this is what I always tell people. Well, okay, if you want to have your one steak a week, eat a free-ranging steak. I'd rather you didn't eat it at all. But once again, it's so frustrating to me when people go, it's so hard, I really want to do this, I can't do it, you know, I travel, you know, they travel from New York to California.
Wow.
God, I spend time in the backwoods of China and India.
Yeah.
Or East Africa.
Yeah.
You can always find vegetarian and vegan alternatives, and you can always be polite about it. So when I travel, I'll usually just tell people, especially people who don't know me or I don't know, that, you know, I always say I'm vegetarian. A lot of people, you know, different countries don't know what vegan is.
Right.
And I always say I'm vegetarian. I don't eat animals or animal products. And never once have I ever had somebody say, oh, well, that's too bad. You know,
right.
You know what I mean?
So. Yeah, well, I have done a lot of traveling, too, and I've eaten vegan in India. I lived in France and had no issues eating vegan all over Europe, North Africa, South Africa, all over the place. And there's just a few things that you need to think of when you're traveling to different places. Certainly, if someone is going to be feeding you, you need to let them know in advance, in a nice way, what you eat and don't eat. And it's not really different from people who are religious and keeping some sort of religious commandment, or people that have different allergies. Certainly, some are more serious than others. People that can't eat peanuts, people that have celiac disease can't eat wheat. There are lots of different things, and we're becoming more focused to people with food issues. And, you know, even in France, where the chef for a long time has believed that everything that he or she presents is what you should eat because it's his work of art, there's more understanding now that people should be served what they want and not necessarily what the chef wants to give customers.
I was once in Southeast France bicycle racing, because I used to race bikes and I've raced in France. And I said I wanted a vegetarian meal, and it was great. I was on a team. The chef came out and he smiled at me. He said to me that he had never met a vegetarian. You know, how would I possibly be able to do the race without eating meat? And, you know, honestly, I wound up winning it. But what was really cool was he didn't come out and laugh at me. He just, he was incredulous that, you know, you could ride your bike and race your bike and not eat meat.
Right.
And so I said, well, give me, I mean, we were so hungry all the time. I said, give me a lot of bread, give me a lot of pasta, give me rice, give me beans, I need protein. You know, give me, you know, give me a bottle of red wine or something. But what was really cool was he was really accepting. And what he told me, and of course I have not been back to this little town, he said he was going to put vegetarian alternatives on his menu because a lot of cyclists, you know, local, came in and ate.
What town was this?
That was so simple.
What was the town?
Oh, it was a town called Gien, G-I-E-N, which is on the, they're all, you know, within probably 100 clicks of Marseille.
Yeah.
Toulon. Toulon is one. Gien, Hyères, that's where the race started.
Right.
You know, but what was so cool to me, the town was literally probably the size of my living room. it was just so nice, and I wasn't arrogant about it because we don't get anywhere by being arrogant.
That's
I just
said,
I do not eat animals. I do not eat animal products. Surely you can make me a pasta meal or potatoes. You know what I mean?
Well, I never had a problem in France, except maybe in Paris. But outside of Paris, everyone was really accommodating, and the chefs would come out kind of like you said, curious, interested. A few of them said they would like to take the challenge and come up with something new and creative. And so it's all about communication. And which is the secret to success in anything, not just with food, but with all relationships and business and with intimate relations and with your family. Communication is so important. And so you have to be clear. And so when you're traveling and if you know people are going to be providing you with food, you have to be clear in advance, because there's nothing like someone who wants to welcome guests and feed them and goes to the trouble to make something, and then you show up and say, oh, I can't eat this, I'm a vegetarian.
Right, because there's a sense of arrogance. I was at a Christmas dinner, or going to a Christmas dinner once, and one of my friends who's vegan said she, you know, and she had, there were some friends visiting, and said, you know, one of the friends wasn't sure that he could sit down at Christmas meal where there was going to be turkey. And my response was, then why in the world did she come?
Right.
And it really, you know, pissed me off, if you will, Karen, because I said, so, she, and then she said, well, what about you? And I said, I'm going to sit there, I'm going to have my vegan meal, and if somebody, because I didn't know some of the people, I said, if somebody asks me, you know, why, what I'm eating or why I'm eating it, I will explain to them. But, you know, just putting it in someone's face like that is the sure way for them to cash out, you know, people who they think are radical as, you know, being nutballs.
Yep.
And the fact is, we should not be the radicals. I mean, my work with kids and my work with, you know, people is to get people who are humane and ethical, who care about, you know, animals, who care about the environment, to be you know, viewed as the mainstream, not the radicals.
Very good. Well, you know, the history of this planet has not necessarily been very kind and compassionate. We've had hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years of all kinds of violence and cruelty. And I would like to think that we're evolving to a better place, and maybe one day the lion will lie down with the lamb. And but the thing is, as individuals, it's so easy to see the horror and be so angry and want to change people and change that misery. But screaming at people and telling them what they want to do, unfortunately, no matter how angry you are, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I was just looking at this movie, Invictus, about Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, oh, what a great film.
It's a great film, and there's a line in it that I wrote down, and I went, yeah, what the hell. And then all of a sudden, about 2 days later, I looked, and it was a simple line where Mandela was telling the football team, go beyond your own expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, and like I've been obsessing on it, and people, some of my friends out here think I'm nuts, and I'm thinking, no, when really what he was saying is don't give up, don't say never, ever, just put it out what you need, seek what you need with compassion and kindness and empathy, and you will, quote, get it. You won't, it may not happen overnight, but I, as an athlete, I think about it like training for a race. You might train for a race for a year. You know, you don't just wake up one morning and say, well, I'm going to, you know, ride a big bike tour or run a marathon. And so you're training yourself, and I think that that's what people need to do. I think people need to be moved out of their comfort zones in compassionate ways.
I agree with you, and I think people would feel a lot better, too. Something I wanted to bring up before that I didn't, this idea of all of us being so disconnected with nature and with the environment and with animals, as a result, we have a big void, and we're not satisfied, we're anxious, and it's because we need this connection with all the other things that we share this planet with, and our lives would be so much fuller and richer if we opened our hearts up to all of these things that are going on around us rather than closing it down.
Right, and I think if we open our hearts, we will actually add joy to our lives by knowing that, you know, we live in a very troubled and a wounded world, but I'm just a diehard optimist. I know what's going on from reading, from traveling, from meeting people, you know, from meeting animals who are abused, but I do think that I'm seeing little rays of hope here and there.
Yeah.
And one would be, of course, a radio show like yours. Another would be working with kids. Another would be, you know, just talking with people. And, you know, over time, like one of my friends sits down and goes, when I have lunch with Mark, I eat vegan. And, hey, it's one meal left.
Right.
That's consuming animals.
Yes.
You know, and I always tell people I will always buy them lunch.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not putting that invitation out to the world. But I am. You know why I do that? I do it not because I'm wealthy, because I'm not. But
of course.
I do it so that they can see that they can enjoy an incredibly good meal.
We do whatever it takes, Mark. I love to prepare food, and so I look forward to inviting people over for dinner, or if there's an event where I know people can bring food, I make the most amazing, delicious things and get it in people's mouths and tell them it's vegan so they know that they can have things that are delicious and tasty and healthy, and they're not going to be deprived. But,
right.
But, Mark, we have to take a break, and it's going to be a couple of minutes. Get a drink of water or whatever, and then we're going to come back. I want to talk about what the animals feel.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll be right back.
Okay.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello! Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me, and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. Welcome back. This is It's All About Food. I'm here with Mark Bickhoff. Mark?
Yep.
You're back. We're back.
Yep.
All right, tell me about this morality with animals.
Well, okay.
That's not something, people talk maybe about animals being sad and having feelings towards their offspring, but I don't hear much about morality.
Right. I mean, people have been writing about moral behavior in animals for a long time. Excuse me, Charles Darwin wrote about the moral sentiment in social animals. But it's something I got interested in, watching animals play with one another, started years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It resulted ultimately in a book I wrote with my colleague Jessica Pierce that was published last year called Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. It basically, I mean, the simple notion is that animals are not as aggressive as the main media and some scientists make them out to be. Across the board, more than 90% of all of the social interactions of great apes, wolves, dolphins, whales, are what we call pro-social, positive cooperative. Of course, animals compete with one another. Of course, they fight with one another. But it is not their main way of interacting. And now people are really getting very interested in the question of whether animals know right from wrong. I mean, it's a clear resounding yes, they do. Are there moral codes of conduct that, you know, inform how they should behave in a group? Yes, there are. So it's really exciting to see that we're going one step up on, if you will, the cognitive capacities of non-human animals. And in Wild Justice, tell stories about elephants helping one another, you know, when one is injured. When I was in Kenya, I, you know, saw an injured elephant female named Babel, who really couldn't walk. She had been limp since she was a kid. And the other elephants in the group waited for her, and they fed her.
Mm.
And some of my colleagues would say, oh, well, you know, there must, you know, they wouldn't do this if Babel couldn't do something for them. Well, the fact is, Babel couldn't do anything if she were left alone.
Mm-hmm.
She definitely would have been, you know, fallen prey to a predator, a lion, or, say, a cheetah. I've seen funeral rituals, if you will, in birds like magpies, red foxes. And when I publish these observations, I I get emails from all over the world, from, you know, scientists and non-scientists alike. So that's basically the state of the art. What we're discovering is that, you know, especially among social animals, there are codes of conduct. They know right from wrong. There are penalties and sanctions when an animal does not behave as he or she is supposed to behave, you know, behave cooperatively or fairly. So I'm excited about it. Because I also wrote a kid's book called Animals at Play, which lays out the rules of play so that kids can see that, you know, when somebody says, oh, you're acting like an animal, that's a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I teach a course in a jail, and I've been teaching there for a decade, and when, you know, something goes, you know, when I say nuts, I don't mean, you know, in a fight way, but if they, you know, if the guys start getting at one another and they go, oh, you're just acting like an animal, I'll always say, oh, but you just complimented them.
All right.
And stuff. So that, I mean, you know, that's kind of the nutshell, that we're really looking at situations where animals, like humans, have this aversion to being treated unfairly. There's a whole area of research developing called inequity aversion. And what it really means is that there's an aversion to being treated inequitably or unfairly. And animals do not like it, and they won't work for lesser pay, and they won't tolerate cheaters in their group.
Well, this can't be good news for the animal industry, which has based itself for a long time on the fact that there really isn't much in the animals' heads that we choose to exploit.
No, it's not good news at all. In fact, just four or five years ago, 2006, there was a wonderful study published showing that mice feel the pain of other mice. Now, 40 years ago, or almost 50 years ago, there were studies done that showed that rats would not eat if eating caused another rat to be shocked. The same study was done in monkeys. And the study that was done a few years ago to show empathy in mice basically reinvented the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people, you know, and, I mean, it's really upsetting. I would never have sanctioned it,
yeah,
but it was done. So I always say, let's use those data.
Absolutely. To not do it anymore.
Yeah, right. Get them into the Federal Animal Welfare Act, and I can tell you right now, cows and pigs and, you know, factory-farmed animals also feel their own pain and the pain of others.
So you've said that animals don't allow themselves to be treated inequitably. So how is it that all of these domesticated animals in factory farms aren't rebelling in some way?
Well, you know, it's a really good question. I mean, inside their hearts and their heads, I'm sure they're going, you know, what in the world is happening?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the word that circus people use, or, you know, cowboys use when they are trying to tame an animal, is break. We're breaking a stallion.
Yeah.
We're breaking an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're really doing is you're breaking their heart.
Yeah.
And it's almost like this phenomenon of learned helplessness. You know, you see it in children, you know, you see it in different animals. All I tell people is, do you love your dog? Yes. Would you do to your dog what you allow to be done to cows and pigs and chimpanzees and mice? Oh, no. Well, why?
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I'll go, no, I don't know. The fact is, these cows, pigs, mice, you know, chimpanzees, elephants, whales, hamsters, guinea pigs are no less sentient than your companion dog or cat. So that's another thing that I've learned, you know, in terms of not putting something in someone's face, but asking the difficult question and putting them out of their comfort zone, saying, well, if you wouldn't allow your dog to go to a factory farm, why do you eat animals off the factory farm?
And the response I hear all too often is, because it tastes good.
Yes, in my book, The Animal Manifesto, I have a section called, I Know They Suffer, But I Love My Steak.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, oh, well, how about your dog? I know he or she suffers, but I'm going to lock them in the closet or stick pins in their nose or shackle them like animals are shackled in factory farms. So All it is, you know, Karen, all it is once again, putting it out there and hoping people will pick it up. One of my favorite sayings is leap and the net will appear.
Yeah, and I a little Indiana Jones for you.
Yeah, and I think, I think as a scientist, you know, really that's the best I can do. I'm putting the information out there, and I'm hoping that a critical mass over time will pick it up and decide to interact with animals and the non-animal world more humanely. I can't. Neither you nor I can control them. We can
That's
just
right.
hope this is the case.
I'm fascinated with the studies you've talked about how animals can feel other animals' pain. And I think there's so much more to that in terms of this consciousness that we are all connected to. And there's actually some science now that's starting to talk about this consciousness that is outside of our brains and tests that they've been doing that might support this possibility. Like there's this giant hard drive out there.
Right.
That saves all of our memories and how we're all connected to it. And the fact that we're so shut down from it, where we're tuning out things that are being put there from other people and other animals because it's too hard to take in, there's so much sadness around as a result.
Right, and if people find that kind of cosmic consciousness idea to be a bit voodoo,
yeah,
there actually are scientific data. Scientists have discovered what they call mirror neurons in animals, and what mirror neurons do is they actually mirror the behavior and the feelings of another animal in another animal's brain. So, I see you do something. And when I see you do something, the same neurons in my brain fire as if I were doing it. And I see or feel something that you're feeling because the same neurons fire. So I'm not arguing that there isn't something, you know, more global and more cosmic.
Sure.
But what I am saying is solid science.
That's right.
Has shown that mirror neurons really are functional so that animals are suffering not only their own pain, but the pain of others.
Can you give an example of a specific story with some, well, you spoke about the elephants. Do you have any other examples of where an animal demonstrates morality? I love those stories.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at the way large animals play with small animals, large kangaroos will not box or push a young kangaroo as hard as they can. We call it self-handicapping. You'll see the same when a large dog plays with a small dog. You know, and some people will go, oh, when I go to the dog, you know, dog park, you know, this kind of stuff escalates into fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes it does, but we actually studied it, and it escalates into fighting about 2% of the time.
Mm.
So we see situations where an injured wolf might be fed by other wolves in his or her pack. An elephant, it was a teenage elephant who had a bad leg, and this rambunctious teenage male came in and knocked her over, and a large adult female went over and drove the male out and went back to the female and touched her trunk to the sore leg.
Mm.
That's understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what people cash it out. The thing is that a lot of the people who are skeptics or naysayers spend their lives watching animals in cages. They watch the same five mice or monkeys in a cage, and it's an impoverished social and physical environment. So the animals aren't able to express their full behavioral repertoire.
That's right.
You know, so really what we need is we have to revise our stereotypes. We have to be patient because the study of animal emotions, animal cognition, animal moral behavior are still in their infancy. But every day, you know, you can hardly pick up the New York Times or big popular magazines without seeing, you know, great articles on the cognitive and emotional lives and the moral lives of animals.
one of my least favorite words is instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And it is used so often to explain some of these phenomena you've been talking about. Oh, it's just instinct.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever your definition of instinct is, it's more than that.
Well, much of our behavior is instinct, but an instinct doesn't mean it can't be modified or changed.
And it can't. And it doesn't mean that the animal isn't thinking. It doesn't mean the animal doesn't feel. It doesn't mean that they're acting as a robot.
No. You're exactly right. And that's one of the things I always counter, that the word instinct, you know, to people who know what it is, it has a lot packed to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you received, you've written a number of books, lots of them, and have you received any negative feedback?
Well, you know, every now and again, you know, somebody will, you know, write, oh, sure, you know, horses get embarrassed. Oh, sure, what about mosquitoes? Or, you know, they think I have an agenda that I'm just sort of, you know, putting it out there with no facts. The fact is that my popular books as well as my scientific books have all been reviewed very favorably, you know, not only in popular press but also in scientific journals. And so, really, I'm not trying to, I'm just painting the picture of who these animals are. Do animals fight with one another? Sure. Can they be mean to one another? Sure. Do they eat one another? Sure. But can they be nice to one another and compassionate and empathic? Yes. Can they be moral? Yes. So, very little negativity.
People could probably relate best to mammals having feelings because they are so similar to us. And so at the very least, we should be having more compassion for our fellow mammals.
Absolutely.
At a minimum. But
right.
I've read so many compelling stories about fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about whales and dolphins, but I'm talking about fish, non-mammal fish,
right,
that have done so many unbelievable things that show their emotions, show their appreciation, show their fear, show their consciousness and their desire to communicate to human beings.
Yeah, I mean,
mind-blowing stories.
Yeah, I mean, there's a new book out called Do Fish Feel Pain? And the woman who wrote it is not necessarily, you know, an animal protection person. But her conclusion is, yes, fish are conscious. Yes, they feel pain. Yes, they suffer. Yes, we have to treat them better. There's many people who have shown that lobsters feel pain, that insects feel pain. And these are scientists who have no vested interest because they're interested in animal rights or animal welfare. They're just doing the science and saying, yes, there's evidence that insects feel pain.
Yeah.
End of story.
So, if for those of you who are listening, just think about, be mindful of what you do, and
yep,
know that what's on your plate, if it's from an animal, if it's meat, fish, chicken, pork, whatever it is, that animal has experienced pain and suffering.
And it's who's on your plate, not what.
And it's who. Thank you. I've got to really,
I didn't mean that in an arrogant way, but no. It's a complete.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's like not referring to animals as witches and thats and
mm-hmm.
it, as his and hers with, you know,
absolutely,
animals with names.
Absolutely.
So anyway, don't take that in any other way. But
no, I feel the love, Mark. I feel the love. Now, when I read your Psychology Today article, you mentioned that cows communicate through staring.
Yeah. Well, a lot of animals do, including humans.
How did you come up with this, and what have you seen through
staring? Well, I didn't do the
study,
but there's people doing studies of cow behavior and pig behavior, especially in the United Kingdom because of the large meat industry there. And, you know, they do studies. They observe the animals. They film them. They watch, you know, how an animal might roll his or her eyeballs, and it elicits a response in another animal. So, I mean, it's a good question, Karen, because animals communicate using extremely subtle signals.
That's fascinating. You know, I have, I go to Costa Rica from time to time. I have some property there, and when I'm walking on these dirt roads, occasionally I'll pass by a collection of cows. And they don't look like a lot of the cows that you find on factory farms in this country. Their udders are naturally small. And but they come to the fence and they stare. And I can't help myself, but I always like to look back and I either say or I'm thinking, I'm not going to eat you. You're my friend. And I just like the interaction that we have between eye contact to eye contact.
Well, you know, they have great, all these animals have great senses of smell, and they can smell our stress, they can smell our intentions, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not fooling them in any way.
Oh, so I can imagine how difficult it is in a factory farm. I've read so much about how the stench is so unbearable with the ammonia, the animals living in their excrement and filth, so they have a tremendous heightened sense of smell to begin with, and then the smells are so horrific that must be such extreme torture.
Okay, I'm here in Boulder. We're about 60 miles away from the town of Greeley, a little northeast of here. And when there's an upslope storm, we know it's upslope because we smell the stench from the stockyards there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're smelling it,
imagine what the animals are going through.
You know what's happening. Yep.
The animals, and here's another thing, people, I'm sure you've heard it, but people say, oh, you love animals so much, what about people? Don't you care about people? And they don't realize that we're all connected, and what we're doing to animals, unfortunately, we do to people. And one of the handful of people, there's less and less of them that work in the factory farms. They're just exposed to all of this. And the people that live in the communities around factory farms are being exploited. The air quality is horrible. The water quality is horrible. I recently read.
Oh, yeah. Factory farm workers really show high percentage of, you know, psychological problems. I would venture to say that 99%+ of people working there are working there because they have to work there. It's their only way to make an income.
Yeah.
So we got to feel for them, and we have to understand that they're not all as privileged as, you know, many of us are, but they do not like what they're doing.
You know, I just recently read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, which has been on my reading list for maybe 40 decades probably. Finally got around to it, and it's a horrific book, and it touches on the slaughterhouses in Chicago and how we treated animals in the early 1900s, but it wasn't even a book about animals. It was about the people that worked for that industry and the torturous life that they went through. And it was heart-wrenching, and I kept thinking, and it's worse now.
Yes.
Oh, so.
Well, listen, I know we're ending, so I'm going to end on a happy
note. Yes, I was just going to say, so let's end on a happy note.
It's simple to make positive changes in the world. It's simple to expand our compassion footprint. What we need to do is set an example and make individual choices to increase, you know, humaneness and compassion in the world. We have to own our decisions, and we can't, you know, any longer accept these lame excuses like, oh, it's too hard to make a change. I travel, or I'm really busy. It's too hard to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, they don't work anymore. And I don't mean that arrogantly. They just don't work anymore. Busy people on the run can easily change their ways. We don't have to eat animals. We don't have to wear animals. We don't have to watch them in circuses, rodeos, and zoos.
And we won't be deprived. We'll feel better. We'll have more energy. Our health will be improved. The food's delicious. It's just a win-win-win-win-win.
Yep.
Mark, thank you very, very much. Thank you for joining us. I know we scheduled this at the last minute, and I'm just really glad that you were able to come on and that you've written all these great books. Is there a website people can check out?
Yeah, the best would just go to my homepage, which is just markbeckoff.com.
That's markbeckoff.com.
Right, and also Jane Goodall on my website has a lot of really good information there, too.
Great. Thank you, Mark. And I'm going to let you go now because I know you have more great things to do.
My pleasure. Thank you, Karen, and thank you, listeners, for listening.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Mark Beckhoff, and his most recent book is The Animal Manifesto, and I highly recommend checking it out. We have a few more minutes, and before we go, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some postings and an article I was just reading today. The Wall Street Journal had an article about this almond milk battle that's going on between Silk and Blue Diamond, and it was an interesting article, and I found some of the responses to it very interesting. But the one thing I want to say is I'm glad that it's out there. We're talking more and more about non-dairy milks because cow's milk isn't healthy, and more people are realizing it. People are lactose intolerant. People have all kinds of issues with dairy. And there are certainly more non-dairy milks out there, rice and soy and almond, hemp, and I'm glad the market's growing. I'm glad there's more competition. There are a lot of things that the article didn't talk about, and I mentioned it in my post comment where the article is on the Wall Street Journal site. But a number of things that people just don't think about. Number one, these non-dairy milks are more expensive than milk, and it's a supply and demand thing. Certainly people are drinking more cow's milk, and so the demand of it makes the price go down. I'm sorry. Because there are more people that are wanting it, we make more of it, it goes down. But also there's tremendous subsidies to grow cattle, and there's milk subsidies to keep the price down. And meanwhile, a lot of these dairy cows are out there, and they're contributing to global warming with methane gas. And I say, why not transfer those subsidies to farmers that are growing organic soy, rice, almonds? They're not contributing to global warming. In fact, their plants are absorbing some of that carbon dioxide and creating oxygen so that they can create and produce more of these healthy non-dairy milks for us. I just made some hemp milk yesterday from hemp seeds, a quarter cup of hemp seeds mixed with about 3 cups of water in a blender. Easy, nutritious, comes with essential fatty acids. Excellent. And I vary it from time to time. You can make your own almond milk just with almonds and water. So many options. Okay. So I wanted to thank you for listening today. You've been listening to It's All About Food. And please, I love to hear your comments and questions. You can send emails to my email is info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Please let me know your thoughts. Next week, we're going to be talking with Sharon Nazarian. She's the Vegan Pimp. She has a website, veganpimp.com, and we're going to be talking to her and hearing a lot of inspirational stories. So thanks for listening. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this has been It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.